Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Happy Monday, my little Liberty Lions, and welcome to your favorite libertarian podcast, the original libertarian variety show, Lions of Liberty. Before we get to today's show, I want to tell you about something that's been going on recently. We have been demonetized on YouTube. That means we can't make a dime off our videos on YouTube just after we put a lot of time and money into making a lot of video interviews for you guys. Thanks to our support on Patreon. Of course, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/lionsofliberty. But I want to tell you about another way you can fight back against the man. And that's by purchasing some delicious coffee, because we have an amazing coffee that we have partnered with Anarcho Coffee to create, and it is called The Morning Roar, and it is delicious. It is a medium dark roast, and it is a fantastic way to start your day and to start your week as you listen to your Monday flagship Lions of Liberty podcast hosted by me. So head over to lionsofliberty.com/coffee, grab yourself some Morning Roar. I will also post the link in today's show notes, which you can find over at lionsofliberty.com/410.
Your host, your guide, your shining beacon of liberty, Mark Claire.
All right, my guest today is a Venezuelan-American freelance writer. You can find his writing at the Mises Institute, at Big League Politics, and at the Advocates for Self-Government. He is also the author of How Socialism Destroyed Venezuela and The 10 Myths of Gun Control. Very pleased to welcome, for the very first time, Jose Nino. Jose, are you ready to roar?
Hell yeah, man. Let's get this started.
All right, man. And, you know, very pleased to speak with you for the first time. I've been familiar with your work for a while here. And, you know, we've got a whole bunch of stuff specifically relating to Venezuela that I want to get into. But first, it's your first time on the show. Why don't you start off telling all the Lions out there a bit about yourself, your childhood, a little bit about where you grew up, and how you became interested in libertarian ideas.
Well, I was originally born in Venezuela, but I came to the States when I was pretty young, around six, like in the late 90s, right before things really started to implode in Venezuela. That was like a year before Hugo Chavez got elected. And my parents, they kind of saw the writing on the wall, especially in 96 when my dad's like small business went under. It's largely due to like the inflation at the time. A lot of people forget that Venezuela had like around 100% inflation, like in the mid 90s. And a lot of that stuff like really hit the middle to lower middle classes and below hard. And my family was one of those sectors of the Venezuelan society that got hit pretty hard by that. So my parents were left with like a pretty tough choice of looking for greener pastures, especially like United States among other countries. And they decided to do what was like best for my sister and I's future and move to the States. And I've always like paid attention in the background to Venezuelan politics, but I was never like really hardcore into it. I got into the liberty movement basically through Ron Paul, just like lurking around a lot of forums and catching some of his videos. Since then, I've been involved in university libertarian groups, such as like Students for Liberty and Young Americans for Liberty. I lived abroad for some time in Chile, where I was doing some graduate studies and doing some freelance work for a free market think tank there. And then I got into the realm of grassroots lobbying and copywriting for the National Association for Gun Rights. And now for the past few months, I've embarked in like a more online career as a freelance writer. And I mostly write about several topics that range from like gun rights to decentralization. I don't write as much about Venezuela, but I did release an ebook on like what's going on there, which is really like a compilation of like my past 3 years work on the subject with some updates and just like modifications to make it like a smoother read.
I'm kind of curious about when you first moved to the US with your family. I know you were pretty young, but I'm curious how much you remember about that time. And if you can think back to that, like what are some of the differences, maybe not even politically, because you probably weren't necessarily thinking in that context at the time, but just what are some of the major differences that struck you, if you can recall, when your family first moved here to America from Venezuela?
Well, I could kind of tell that things were starting to go bad because around the apartment complex I lived in Valencia, Venezuela, which is one of the largest cities in Venezuela after Caracas, the capital, and Maracaibo. It's a city of about nearly 2 million people. In the apartment complex where I was at, there were like armed guards, like with like machine guns and rifles. That was like a very like lurid image of like my childhood that I still remember to these days. But it was definitely, from the times I've visited, like over the past few years, it's definitely more stable when you look at it from the relative sense. I mean, I would definitely trade mid-90s Venezuela with all its problems for present day Venezuela. But it was definitely a society in the decline at that time. But really, that's a big theme of what a lot of my works around Venezuela have been about, is that Venezuelan society, especially like its economy, has been declining for a while, for multiple decades, in fact. And that's what contributed largely to the rise of Chavismo, Hugo Chavez's ideology there, and that it was not an overnight process whatsoever.
So let's dig into that a little bit more. When did it all begin? I mean, at what point, based on the work you've done in regards to Venezuela, would you say that socialism began to really take hold and sort of led to eventually what we see today?
Well, I come from a historical background, and I like to view things from a historic lens, especially macro trends. And we have to understand that Venezuela didn't just get rich because of oil initially. It actually had a pretty hands-off approach to economic affairs from the 1910s up until the 1970s. There was like hardly any taxation or regulation. Central banking only came in until 1939. So Venezuela at that time was late to that party, and for good reason. And its relatively free economy in conjunction with discovery of oil attracted a lot of skilled labor from Italy, Portugal, Spain, Colombia, its next door neighbor, and even Lebanese and Syrian Christians as well. And that created like a pretty strong economic environment for growth and modernization for the country. But in the 1950s, Venezuela was one of the richest countries in the planet on a per capita GDP basis. But a lot of things started to slowly unravel when the country went back to democracy in 1958. And they slowly started to implement a lot of like socialist-like policies since then. There was a bipartisan political order between a party called Acción Democrática, Democratic Action, and COPE, Christian Democrats. They would take turns in power and pursue very similar policies. There was not much of a difference. And in 1970s is when I believe, in my opinion, that the Venezuelan economy was like fundamentally altered when the government completely nationalized its oil industry. This goes contrary to a lot of typical Fox News takes you hear these days, that they say that Hugo Chavez nationalized the oil industry. It's factually not true. That was the government of Carlos Andrés Pérez, the president of of democratic action at the time in the mid-1970s. Since then, the Venezuelan economy has been completely controlled by the state. The state basically treated the oil industry as like a massive piggy bank to dole out crony capitalistic subsidies to the companies, to also just hand out money to potential voting blocs, as well as to politicize other institutions like the central bank. The government bought a majority stock in the central bank so that it could pursue a more easy money policy. And not even like a decade took place when the Venezuelan government decided to devalue its currency in 1983 after the government engaged in a huge spending binge during the nationalization period of its oil industry, because there was a belief that with a nationalized oil industry, Venezuela could pay for all these types of goods and services through state control, through capturing oil rents and revenue like that and redistributing it. And essentially, it went into kind of like a lost decade in the 1980s. Venezuelans actually started to get poor. It was almost expected that from during like the mid-20th century that the Venezuelan economy would always grow. But that was not the case. And ironically, in the 90s and late 80s, Carlos Andrés Pérez gets reelected and he promises the same bonanza. But once he assumes power, he realizes that the Venezuelan state is completely bankrupt. The economy is completely shackled by regulations and government control. And overall, like, Venezuela could not compete on the international level thanks to its protectionist policies. So he turns to the IMF, which gives him a bunch of half-assed advice. Like, there was some decent stuff like privatization of industry, cutting tariffs and some subsidies, but didn't really go far enough as far as taming inflation, which was becoming a problem, and privatizing the oil industry. Funny part is that Pérez's own party, Democratic Action, completely hated these reforms because they're a social democrat member of the Socialist International, and they did not approve. So they were able to channel a lot of protests out in the street. Even like more radical leftist elements came out, and it resulted in a massive crackdown called the Caracazo in 1989, when inflation was like close to like 60%. And the government actually cracked down violently, killed like hundreds of people. And that was not the end of the political instability. In 1992, you had a man by the name of Hugo Chavez, who was the lieutenant colonel at the time, launch two unsuccessful coups against Carlos Andrés Pérez's government. And even though they were failures, they completely shattered the political system. People lost trust in Carlos Andrés Pérez, and he was ironically impeached by his own party in 1994, I believe, for like embezzlement charges. And from that point forward, the bipartisan order of the Acción Democrática and the Social Democrats completely imploded. And that laid the groundwork for Hugo Chavez's movement while he was actually in prison, but was able to pick up a lot of steam because people were on net poor and hated the political system there. So when Chavez was pardoned in 1996, he had an easy base to tap into. He completely bashed the previous political order. He actually campaigned as a centrist. And by 1998, it was a wrap. Like, he won pretty decisively. And most people were really pissed off with the previous political system, but they had no idea what they voted for then.
All right. Often you see these revolutionaries and people get excited because they hate their government so much that they embrace someone who is strong and promising change. And obviously, Chavez kind of built his name for himself with those attempted coups, which did lead ultimately to him becoming president. I do want to kind of tick back a little bit further and try to just wrap my head around how this kind of happens to a nation like Venezuela, where things seem to be going pretty well. They seem to have pretty free markets. The economy is doing well. You know, in the 1950s, 50s. And then at some point, the government just starts to institute more socialist policies. Perhaps not coincidentally, as you mentioned, as it became more of a democratic country. Is that almost something that's maybe inevitable in some ways? As a country becomes wealthier, people might just expect more things from that sort of wealthier nation? Or is there some sort of specifics that you can point to in terms of why Venezuela sort of taking that turn? Obviously, socialism is something that has sort of creeped its way throughout all of South America, you know, over the decades. But what kind of insight can you provide on the reasons behind why, you know, that turn started to come in?
Well, I go over this in my ebook as well. Really, it's a cultural and political institutional problem with Latin America. It just doesn't have the same foundation as like the U.S. Like the U.S. Declaration of Independence was based upon classical liberal principles. They weren't just saying like, screw the British. They were actually reasserting rights that they enjoyed as like subjects of the British empire, but that the British crown completely destroyed. But the in the Latin American case, it was mostly just a group of colonial elites that really just wanted to recreate their own noble fiefdoms, because they actually feared that the Spanish government at the time, which was occupied by Napoleon Bonaparte and his brother, were actually going to implement very classical liberal reforms and strip colonial elites of their privileges. So even like in after independence was successfully attained in Venezuela, a lot of these countries maintained really strong colonial mercantilistic institutions that were very corrupt. And that was always a very strong rallying point for a lot of leftist ideologies, because when you look at a lot of the right wing in these countries, they tend to be very corrupt. So it's easy for leftists to mobilize against them. But in the Venezuelan case, its best governments have historically been under military dictatorships for the most part, because they were not very activist in economic affairs. And the opposition to these governments was overwhelmingly socialist, like even communist. In fact, the founder of like the modern Venezuelan democracy of the Fourth Republic from 1958 to 1998, Romulo Betancourt, was a reformed communist turned social democrat. He was like the founder of Acción Democrática. They actually didn't disagree with the communistic vision. They just disagreed with the means of implementing it. They rejected revolution, but they believed that it could be implemented through the ballot box. And that's always been a really big lingering problem in Venezuela, that the overall culture there, especially after the oil nationalization, has been just infected by top-down central planning ideologies. Every party you see, even to the present and among the opposition, is just completely brainwashed into these ideas. The only exception, I would argue, is coalition formed by Maria Corina Machado, who is the leader of a centrist market-oriented party called Vente Venezuela, Come Venezuela. There really aren't any free market alternatives in the country. And I think that's not a coincidence. It's part of a larger macro cultural and political trend in the country that's been in existence for the past 60 years or so.
I want to discuss kind of getting to the reign of Chavez a little bit more and kind of try to tie that in with when Venezuela became an area of interest to the United States. I believe there is at least one or maybe more coup attempts believed to be by the CIA, who knows how much evidence we really have to that end, against Chavez. And he was also a very outspoken anti-imperialist. So there's kind of a few ways you can view Chavez. You can view him as the socialist leader that he certainly was. You can also, you know, view him as sort of a staunch anti-imperialist. So how much of the United States' interest in Venezuela was sort of sparked by Chavez, and how much of it can, as far as you can tell, was related more, you know, directly just towards the oil resources and that sort of thing?
Well, interestingly, Chavez's first years in office, he was actually kind of centrist. He even privatized like certain industries, I think like in the mining sector. But It wasn't after, I would say, I think things changed after 9/11, interestingly, because the U.S. was completely emboldened by that. They were ready to do regime change everywhere. And when Chavez tried nationalizing the oil industry in 2002, there was a coup against him that successfully deposed him for a day, but then he was able to get back in power. And there was a lot of evidence that the CIA was involved, and that completely emboldened him. He went from like a centrist to a full-blown radical, but he actually didn't brand his movement socialist till I believe around 2006 or 2007, when he changed the party he was part of to the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, because his movement originally was the Fifth Republic Movement of Venezuela. And the U.S. has had an interest because, like, let's face it, the U.S. is the most powerful country on the planet, and it's willing to do regime change wherever it pleases. And when you see a rogue regime in its own backyard, it's going to be involved in some capacity. The thing is that I think, like, when you look at the neoconservative establishment, their main focus the past 20 years has been the Middle East. So Venezuela has kind of taken somewhat of a backseat, but that should not be confused for the fact that they've been wanting regime change for some time there. They've tried getting involved through a lot of these student groups. You see a lot of the really socialist-like opposition pal around with a lot of think tanks in Washington, D.C., like the American Enterprise Institute and other groups, in efforts to try to, like, topple whoever has been in power, whether it be Chavez or Maduro. I do think Venezuela's entire economic debacle is, for the most part, self-inflicted. It's been collapsing even before Chavez. But I think that the U.S.'s policy of trying to do regime change has actually emboldened both Chavez and Maduro's current regime, because that's the problem with sanctions and all these other policies. They end up hurting the people and empowering the government.
And then when the people see or perceive that the United States is attempting to overthrow their leader, naturally, they're just going to rally around that leader, probably almost whoever they are, even if they might dislike their leader. A bad leader that they sort of chose or that their country chose through their system is still going to look a lot better to them than the United States coming in from outside and installing their own dictator.
That's right. I will point out that the U.S. maintained a relatively hands-off policy with sanctions and other, like, overt regime change type of policies after the 2002 coup. But the Trump administration has been relatively hawkish, though, on Venezuela to an unprecedented degree. And they've given a lot of their measures a lot of teeth, too. So, indeed, they have been trying to topple the Maduro government, and it's failed so far. And in fact, I've read some reports that the Maduro government is actually stronger than ever.
And you think that's in large part due to, like you mentioned, the increasing, boldness of the Trump administration to sort of put pressure on Venezuela or kind of make them a target once again after the U.S. was somewhat hands off for the last decade plus?
Yes, I mean, it's that. I also think, too, the opposition in Venezuela, to be quite frank, sucks, like, ideologically. I don't think they offer much, like, to get the country moving again. I think that they need a very clear free market alternative, but it's just not there. Also, the U.S. involvement there's a bigger geopolitical play too. Because of the fact that U.S. is parked everywhere, especially in the Middle East, superpowers like China, Russia, and even lesser powers like Iran have also parked in the U.S.'s backyard, specifically in Venezuela. As a way to kind of give it the middle finger for a lot of the stuff it does abroad, because the U.S. is no longer the only sheriff in town. We already saw that with Syria. Now that, like, Russia is heavily involved there, and same thing with Iran, that there will be antagonistic powers that will check U.S. foreign policy adventures. And Venezuela is also a staging ground for that now. And that's why you're seeing a lot of hawks. Well, you saw that specifically from like January until April. Venezuela hawks really dialing down the pressure there because of like the heavy foreign involvement. But I think it's part of a larger geopolitical game now. We're not talking just about like the failure of like certain Venezuelan economic policies. We're talking about a kind of like proxy conflict between certain factions of global superpowers.
Something I hear a lot from people involved in Venezuela is that there's direct involvement up to possibly including troops of the Cuban government, which actually struck me as pretty interesting because, you know, as far as I know, Cuba's relatively poor. Of course, the people in the government have you know, any money that there is, any wealth there is, it's mostly concentrated there. How much, as far as you're aware, is the Cuban government directly involved in Venezuela and with the Maduro government?
I forgot to mention them as well. Yeah, they're very involved. I remember when I was there, it was like in 2014. There was definitely like some security detail that I noticed that had Cuban accents and stuff like that. Because, yeah, the rumor is that a lot of Cuban intelligence and troops are there. And it also makes sense from a geopolitical standpoint because Cuba is part of that same China, Russia, Iran axis, and they've had very good relationships with Venezuela. They get oil and other resources from Venezuela, and they're a mutual trading partner because the U.S. hates them as well.
So there is, in some ways, it seems just like an old school, almost Cold War-ish alliance that is sort of come together or has remained together, I guess, over the decades against the United States. I guess one of the major differences being, you know, the United States can no longer seemingly just run roughshod all over the place. Now there is a lot of resistance to overthrowing governments such as that in Venezuela.
Oh, definitely. And that's why I think like Russia and China that are very involved there, because even like major superpowers like the US, there's going to always be imperial overstretch. So they're going to set up their assets like in our backyard, our blind spot. So yeah, I don't really put it past them considering the US's track record.
I want to get a little more into the most recent goings on in Venezuela. It does seem there was an attempted coup, an attempt to put this guy Juan Guaido into power. And I'm sure you're familiar with the controversy, some of the controversies that have been going on within the libertarian movement. I'm not going to go naming names. Anybody that kind of follows this stuff knows what I'm talking about. But you know, there are basically a couple different factions out there in the libertarian movement. There are some that really support not government. I don't think any faction in the libertarian movement supports the United States government getting involved in Venezuela, but there are some that do support kind of helping certain factions in Venezuela, you know, through private or voluntary means, to sort of get Guaido into power as in terms of just representing the rule of law. Some claim he should be the rightful president, with the idea being that that could potentially lead to an actual libertarian government, perhaps led by Marina Corina Machado, who is, you know, kind of like a classical liberal. She might not be an ANCAP, but she's certainly much closer to that than obviously the current government's there. And then there's kind of another side to that would just say, hands off, you know, we shouldn't be involved at all. We shouldn't be supporting this Guaido guy because he's clearly a CIA puppet. And then, you know, coming back to them, that faction will sort of be called, you know, Maduro propagandists and that sort of thing. So where do you sort of fall within this whole dialogue in terms of how libertarians should be viewing the situation in Venezuela? I guess specifically when it comes down to this sort of conflict over Guaido versus Maduro, and, you know, should libertarians even be picking a side here? Because I don't think anyone involved is a libertarian or an angel of any kind.
Yeah, this is a complicated question, but I've actually written about how breaking up Venezuela would actually be a good idea, especially like a secessionist movement in the western region of the country, which is actually pretty clearly dissimilar from the rest of, like, say, Caracas and other parts of central Venezuela. But I prefer, like, obviously, like, more privatized alternatives. I'd like to see, like, private defense. I'm very partial to those ideas of kind of like decentralizing the country. because I think we do need more nation states. We need more city states. We need more competing jurisdictions. But I don't want that to be necessarily done through like state intervention. Now, I think that like, yeah, I've been kind of in the loop on some of that whole controversy there.
It's hard to avoid if you're a libertarian on the internet sometimes.
Yeah, indeed. I'm not a fan of Juan Guaido, especially his party Voluntad Popular, which is Spanish for popular will. They're a member of the Socialist International. They're essentially the children of the failed political order of pre-Chavez era, of the pre-Chavez era. And I think that they'll repeat a lot of the stupid mistakes, and they won't implement the same kind of they won't implement the reforms that are needed to move the country forward. And I don't even think they might stay in power that long if they somehow get into power too. So there's that. I think that the country does need like a very strong type of like market like opposition in the mold of like the Eastern European countries, and also like an almost quasi-nationalist movement, if you will, like Eastern Europe, because it is clear the country, there is like foreign interference in, no matter how you slice it, but it's a good way to rally around the issue, around like some type of like free market nationalism. But I don't really think in the present moment that there's really much to do there. I do salute efforts to conduct like private like ventures inside of there to try to raise awareness and possibly promote a peaceful transition out of its current regime. But I don't trust the current opposition that's there at the moment.
Do you believe that Guaido is actually a CIA puppet in the sort of direct sense, or do you believe he just kind of aligns with their current interests? So, you know, perhaps they're backing him for, you know, some sort of short term game.
I haven't really looked into the topic that much. That being said, from what I've gathered, he has been involved in a lot of like the DC think tank sphere, especially those groups of students. The guy's young. I think he's like 35 or 36. And the opposition has been trying to put some people in the Washington, D.C. pipeline, try to get them trained.
Always a little suspicious.
Like, one of the people that has been pretty notorious in promoting that is Roger Noriega of the American Enterprise Institute. He goes around, like, Latin America. He does a lot of decent projects, like, promoting, like, market-oriented stuff and educating like Latin American politicians and would-be politicians there about certain free market principles. But I think with the Venezuelan class, these people that you're dealing with, they're all social democrats for the most part. And they're not going to implement fully a lot of the stuff that they'll impart on them. And also it's AAI, which is a pretty neocon conservatism Inc. type of institution. So there's not much to expect from them there. And I can't really point to anything that says that he's a CIA puppet, but I do think he aligns with American interests since they want to get Maduro out. And they wanted to make a geopolitical statement to countries like Cuba, Russia, and China.
Where does this idea come from? I hear this a lot, and I've never really fully understood it, that Guaido is actually the rightful president through some sort of constitutional manner, which is an interesting outlook for libertarians to take, but some do point to that point, whatever it may be, in the hopes that, you know, at least installing the rightful government could lead to elections, which could lead to an actually better or more libertarian government. But where does this idea that he is somehow the more rightful president than Maduro, obviously neither of them are ideal from a libertarian perspective, but do you know where that idea comes from?
Yes. In 2018, Maduro called a snap election after a lot of pressure from like the opposition so that he could like establish his political legitimacy. It was going to try to play out like other presidential elections where the government would hold an election that was laced with a lot of fraud, like, well, at least allegations of fraud and all of that. And then like the government would win, the opposition would complain, rinse and repeat. Well, it didn't go as planned because when Maduro launched his snap election, the majority of the opposition abstained. In fact, I think that was because of orders from like the State Department and other international organizations to specifically do that. And what was left of the opposition to Maduro in that snap election was a candidate by the name of Henry Falcón, who a lot of people think is controlled opposition. He was a former Chavista that defected to the opposition in Venezuela. And he's always been on kind of friendly terms with Maduro. Like, they disagree with the way the country's going, but he's kind of like a palatable opposition for the government to handle. And Maduro ended up winning in a landslide, but the opposition did not recognize the results. And they used that as a play that this entire snap election was illegitimate. And thus, according to the Venezuelan constitution, the illegitimacy of this election leads to the leader of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, becoming the interim president of the country for the time being.
So he was never even running for president. They're just saying that it's because of the, because Maduro's snap election, they're saying was illegitimate by default. If you accept that that was illegitimate by default, according to the constitution, Guaido would be the leader, you know, if you accepted that premise.
Yeah, that's basically the play. Now, the problem with that is that I think, like, this is my more nuanced take. Venezuela is so institutionally and culturally depleted that you can't rely on constitutional tricks to somehow topple that regime. They were essentially using a political play to gain international recognition. But in Venezuela, at this point, you have to have pretty strong military force behind you to like enforce that part of the constitution. And the opposition does not have that, nor do they have enough popular support on the ground to do so. But I think that Venezuela has hit such a primitive state of politics that's gone like really back to basics. It's all politics comes through the barrel of a gun, just like Mao Zedong said. And that's what Venezuela it is. It's like a, it's kind of like in a state of nature. So I think like the whole, that whole coup thing, that was just cosmetics. Like, they never had any type of armaments or ability to dish out punishment towards the government to even topple that regime. That was just a paper candidacy launched by the State Department in hopes of somehow toppling the Maduro regime, which has always had pretty strong control, not only just through the state, but also through a lot of the criminal and paramilitary elements there. And the opposition in Venezuela, it's big, but not big enough to topple Maduro.
How does someone like Maduro stay so popular in general? I mean, you mentioned that he does have, you know, pretty widespread support, even as the economy continues to collapse, even as things seemingly just get worse and worse and worse as far as inflation, food shortages, and all this stuff. How does someone like that maintain popularity through such terrible conditions?
Well, one thing to note, this is not occurring in a vacuum. A lot of people have left Venezuela, which includes a lot of people that could potentially be in the opposition. So the brain drain really hurts the opposition bad. So it's not a matter of Maduro receiving overwhelming support from the populace, like exclusively. It's also the fact that he has an environment that's pretty favorable towards the incumbent. It also helps that he has foreign governments propping him up, like China, Russia, Cuba. And you have an opposition that's pretty feckless as well. It's a perfect storm for a tyrannical incumbent there. And yeah, and I think like this goes to show that like in politics, like it's not about necessarily having the right ideas. If you cannot mobilize, you will not win. That's plain and simple. It's a very value neutral art where those with the best tactics and mobilization strategies are the ones that end up coming out on top. And so far, the Maduro government has that in their favor.
Hey friends, I got to take a quick pause here to tell you about another great libertarian podcast out there. It's called Free Man Beyond the Wall, hosted by the artist formerly known as Mance Rayder, now known simply by his real name of Pete Raymond. And I gotta tell you, Pete is a machine. This guy brings you a new episode of his own every single Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and he has done some absolutely fantastic in-depth interviews. He's had on everybody from Ron Paul to Thaddeus Russell to Phil LaBonte, the lead singer of All That Remains, a very diverse group of guests, not always libertarians. He also did a great show with a Washington, D.C. insider lobbyist revealing a lot of the dirt that goes on behind the scenes in DC. He has done so many interviews that I have just said, darn, I wish I did this one myself. So I really do want to highly recommend checking out Free Man Beyond the Wall. You can find it over at freemanbeyondthewall.com, as well as iTunes, Stitcher, and all those fancy podcatchers out there.
One thing I definitely want to touch on, because it's something that you write about so much and that you're so passionate about, is the topic of gun control as it relates to Venezuela. When did gun control start becoming a factor into Venezuela? And how do you see things playing out in Venezuela if it had just, you know, maybe done everything it had tried to do over the years, but had remained, you know, had allowed an armed citizenry? Maybe we can learn some lessons from that, you know, based on what a lot of people want to see here in the United States as it relates to gun control.
First of all, Venezuela really never had the Second Amendment. In fact, starting like in the 1930s, it passed very draconian gun control where you could only have like single shot, like 22 rifles. And the only way you could carry like a handgun was if like you were like the military or private security, and you had to also jump through a bunch of hoops. So that's just not there. And this goes back to one of my previous points that like the Anglo-Saxon tradition of like an armed citizenry, whether it's like militia or private citizens owning guns, was never really a thing in Latin America, especially in Venezuela. The only people that generally had guns in those in Latin American countries were people connected to the nobility, soldiers, certain members of law enforcement. And in modern times, private security, which is heavily licensed by the state, and paramilitary or criminal elements. So that never really existed. What you see people talking about now were specifically these measures, like this armament measures that were passed both under Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro, where they confiscated certain firearms in response to a lot of the crime waves that Venezuela's had. Crime waves have been a thing in Venezuela since the 80s, and that's part of the economic and cultural breakdown of the country. And the only people that really have the guns now are like the militias connected to the state, and criminals and the government, obviously. But I think that, yeah, it does show that like the Second Amendment, a lot of people take for granted here, because in times of crisis, you definitely want it. You definitely don't want to be unarmed, because the history of tyrannical governments and gun control is inextricably linked. And you could see it from even like Cuba, Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, Mao's China. They always seized the guns or took advantage of previous gun control measures to seize guns under tyrannical regimes. And it's an insurance policy ultimately against tyranny, against like complete breakdown. Because in Venezuela, what we see is not necessarily like a Soviet-like system of like systematic tyranny. You see a form of anarcho-tyranny, meaning where the government just lets criminals run loose without impunity and just attack and prey upon the population. They don't have to send like jackboots in to tyrannize people. They have a lot of paramilitary and criminal actors to do that, and it installs fear in the population. And when they're disarmed, they have no means of fighting back against it.
So people just generally just completely feel paralyzed because, you know, they're kind of getting hit from every angle, whether it's economically, the government cracking down, or like you said, these non-government actors that they're just completely defenseless against.
Yeah, it's essentially that. There are a lot of people. I have like some distant family members and friends that I still am in touch with that end up getting guns on the black market because that's how they're going to survive there. But a lot of people don't do that because they prefer to be law-abiding in that sense. But there are peripheral areas, especially in Western Venezuela, where people have just said, screw it, we're going to get guns regardless of whatever like freaking laws are on the books. And that's what generally happens, because when you're talking about survival, you're going to do whatever it takes to make it out one day or live another day. So yeah, it's definitely a Mad Max situation there. And a lot of times it pays to break the rules.
I'm just curious, as we wrap up here, Jose, just your general thoughts after obviously you're you know, growing up there and your connections with family and the people you still know there, combined with all the research you've done on this topic in the past few years, is there any hope? I mean, is there any hope to see a non-socialist, non-strong-armed government in Venezuela? Is there any hope for the libertarians? That I know there are libertarian movements in Venezuela, as small as they may be. Is there any hope that some of this can turn around eventually? Or are we just at the point where we're kind of at the point of no return and it's just going to sort of continue to spiral?
In the short and medium term, I'm pretty pessimistic, because I think the country needs to be ideologically and culturally red-pilled. Until that happens, you're going to see a lot more of the same. Either the government's going to stay in power, or if the opposition somehow pulls it off, it's going to be a very weak government that doesn't do the right reforms that are needed to get the country up and running again. And then it's going to probably switch back to some like permutation of Chavez or Maduro's regimes. It's pretty bleak. I think in the long term, anything's possible. And we already saw that with the collapse of the Soviet Union. After nearly like 70 years in power, it eventually disintegrated. And you saw some positive developments with the Baltic Tigers, like Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And I think Venezuela should look at those examples, or like other Eastern European countries and Central European countries that had socialist governments or puppet governments there as models. But right now, I find it very difficult for the country to move forward. And I think in the next 5 years, I wouldn't expect much different.
Well, hopefully enough Venezuelans can somehow, you know, catch a few minutes of Wi-Fi and stumble along the right libertarian free market content or ideas somehow, and you know, eventually red pill enough people to make some change. But obviously, this is not going to be an easy battle. It's not the kind of change that's going to happen overnight. And in some ways, it really does make you appreciate that for all the problems in the United States, for all the talk of socialism, and there certainly is a lot of talk of it, at least we do have the underlying concept of freedom that we can keep pointing back to. Whereas a country like Venezuela simply doesn't even have that base at all. So there's not even, you know, that older culture to point back to, or that base culture where you can kind of draw from. It has to really just be generated from the ground up. Jose, it's been a great time talking to you. I really do appreciate your perspective on Venezuela. Can you just let everybody out there know, before I let you go, how they can find all your writing and how they can, of course, get access to your books?
Okay. Yeah, if you go to my website, josealnino.com, you can find my works there, specifically on my newsletter, josealnino.com/newsletter. And to get my books, just go on josealnino.com/how-socialism-destroyed-Venezuela for my Venezuela book. And for my gun book, it's josealnino.com/10-myths-gun-control. And for social media, I'm mostly on Twitter at Jose Al Nino. And yeah, those are the main places I'm at. I have a daily email list. I'm mostly tweeting my articles at Mises.com, Ammo.com, and Big League Politics. I'm generally very active on social media with regards to topics like, say, gun rights or whatever's hot in the U.S. as well. I'm not writing as much on Venezuela these days, though.
All right, well, Jose, I really do appreciate your time. I'll be sure to link to everything you mentioned in the show notes for today's episode. Please do keep up the great work. I know I don't need to tell you to do that, and keep on roaring, Jose.
Thank you so much, Mark.
All right, kitty cats, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jose Nino, an often requested guest. And when my fans and friends make requests of me, I try to deliver. I do my best. You can get into our ear by heading over to our forum, the Lions of Liberty Forum, our group on Facebook. You have to answer a very tricky question to get in about how you first found out about this podcast. And then you can interact with us and communicate with us. And if you want to interact with us on an even higher level, up to and including potentially monthly calls, you can support us on Patreon. Fight the man, fight YouTube for demonetizing us, and support us on Patreon over at patreon.com/Lions of Liberty. That is largely what keeps this show going. We do not take a dime out of that for ourselves. Myself, Brian, and Odie put every single penny from that Patreon right back into this program. Help us go to events like Porkfest, like the Libertarian National Convention, which we plan to go to again next year, like Childeberg Dose. We're going to hit all the major libertarian parties, at least all the ones that we can head to. You like how I say parties, not events? Because they are parties. When you meet up with a bunch of libertarians in random places across the country, it becomes a party. It becomes a place to make new friends and connect with people. So I highly recommend people do that. But you can support us doing that again by heading over to patreon.com/Lions of Liberty. If you can't make it to everything, you may as well send us to these things and help us do podcasts and videos and all sorts of fun things like that. But friends, don't forget, it's not just me here. I know it seems like it's just me with my epic Monday roars, but I have friends, I have compatriots, I have more fellow Lions of Liberty here with me on the Lions of Liberty podcast feed. Three podcasts for the price of one, and that price is free. All you gotta do is hit that subscribe button, and you get three amazing podcasts each and every single week, starting with me on the flagship program every single Monday, where I bring you interviews like the one you heard today, debates sometimes, roundtable discussions when we do libertarians in living rooms drinking liquor. We have so much fun on the flagship, but it doesn't end there, because Brian McWilliams smacks you upside the head with his weekly shot of mispronunciations, comedy, and liberty on Electric Liberty Land, while John Odie Odermatt wraps things up every Friday with his incredibly inspiring, hard-hitting look at the broken criminal justice system on Felony Friday. You get it all here each and every week on Lions of Liberty without fail. We don't take breaks. We don't take vacations. We deliver no matter what is going on in our lives, because we make things happen, because we love you. We love you for being here. We love you for listening. We love you for downloading. And we love you for being a part of this amazing, growing libertarian movement. And until next time, friends, live long! And live free.